Hi, Craig. How you doing? It's just you and me, buddy. Just you and me. The other grumpy dungeon master. Oh, there he is. Hi, Jay. How's it going?
Wow, you did this whole podcast by yourself. That's fucking amazing. I'm going home.
Good night. Have a good night. Bye.
Hey, buddy. What's up?
I am just off the back of a 5-hour game. It went well. Had a lot of really good moments where a lot of people are like just barely surviving by the skin of their teeth. Fun was had all around, I believe. I hope. And one thing to note is if you're triggering the self-destruct of a building and you press all the buttons and nothing happens, you didn't press all the buttons. The alarms have to start blaring. Things have beep, to start shaking.
Beep, beep. Self-destruct initiated. Yeah, you have to have that anytime you do a self-destruct, no matter what the game is. It's funny. It's kind of funny you had mentioned that because I wanted to actually talk tonight, and we can cover it later, but I wanted to talk about technology in D&D specifically.
And that's a rough one because right now I think the core D&D setting allows guns of like the flintlock-ish variety.
So
reload as fast as a crossbow.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't understand it. Mind you, I don't really follow Forgotten Realms that closely. It used to be that Gond, which is the god of invention, had given people smoke powder, is what they called it. And they had arquebuses, which are just, they're like first generation rifles, you know. They're just as likely to blow up on you as they are to actually shoot the enemy. But from what I was reading online, was apparently smoke powder has mostly been done away with, even though I know that there are guns in Forgotten Realm currently. So I'm very confused. I just need to maybe do more digging and reading on it.
Yeah, so I'm Chris, and this is Jay, and this is the Grumpy Dungeon Masters, and now that that's out of the way.
I thought you already did the intro.
Nope, I was just talking to myself. We never actually got to the intro part.
Oh, okay. I just thought you and Craig were doing it by yourselves.
I was trying to, but you showed up and you interrupted me.
I'll make sure I'm a little slower next time.
So, to kind of answer your question, I will find these stupid monsters. Here it is. So in Waterdeep, okay, the campaign setting, Waterdeep Dragon Heist, I think it was one of the first ones for 5th edition. There are a number of drow gunslingers.
What in that the setting. Fuck?
Yeah. So the description of them is as follows. It says, firearms aren't widely available in the north, but some members of Bregan Dareth are equipped with Lantanese pistols, bullets, and packets of smoke powder. These drow gunslingers are expert pistoliers, as skilled with their guns as the best archers are with their bow. Now, smoke powder is considered a wondrous item. It's uncommon. Smoke powder is a magical explosive, chiefly used to propel a bullet out of the barrel of a firearm. It is stored in airtight wooden kegs or tiny waterproof leather packets. A packet contains enough smoke powder for 5 shots. A keg holds enough smoke powder for 500 shots. If smoke powder is set on fire, dropped, or otherwise handled roughly, it explodes and deals fire damage to each creature or object within 20 feet. 1d6 for a packet, 9d6 for a keg. A successful DC 12 dexterity saving throw halves the damage. Casting dispel magic on smoke powder renders it permanently inert. So, essentially, it's a 5-shot pistol.
Yeah.
They also have the ability to poison their pistol,
I'm going to shoot you with lead, which is going to poison your blood in the first place. And if I shoot you in the abdomen, you know, you might get fecal matter into your blood, which would also poison you. But on top of that, I think I'm going to put a little wyvern's poison on the bullet.
So that's the only part that really I don't like is the poison pistol part.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little too far-fetched for me. But pistol by itself, it does 1d10 plus dex.
As much as I really want to hate the idea of drow gunslingers, at least the description you gave me matches up with everything that I know.
Right.
Because Bregan D'Arth, like, they are sort of the rogues of Minza Berenzin. They have contacts in the overworld. They are there fairly frequently. So that actually kind of makes sense that they would be the dark elves to actually do that, if any dark elves ever would. Then there was the fact that you said it's not widely available in the north, which also is true from everything that I was reading. In Cormyr and like the Waterdeep and those northern territories, it's pretty much been outlawed unless you have a permit, and then it's still heavily, heavily scrutinized.
Right. And
so the fact that they're using Lantanese, I'm not familiar with where, I'm guessing the name of the country is Lantan or wherever. I don't know this place, but I've never heard of it, which means it's probably not in the north anywhere. So.
Yeah. The thing to understand about firearms in D&D, and this is straight from the Dungeon Master's Workshop, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's in the Dungeon Master's Guide.
Firearms are in the DMG, yes.
Yes. So no one has proficiency from start with pistols at all. Yeah. And you have to use animation or ammunition. And they do have a burst fire property, I believe, in all of them that lets you do a spray of like a 10-foot cube area with shots.
You get to right click McCree.
Right. You get to right click McCree and it uses 10 pieces of ammunition. And then you got to reload as an action or bonus action character's choice. Now in the DMG, there's only, they have the Renaissance items, which is basically what you find in D&D, which is pistol and musket.
Yep.
Pistols 1d12, muskets pistols 1d10, muskets 1d12, and it's two-handed. And that the 1d12 is better than any bow out there. The pistol is equivalent to a crossbow. You get to add your dex modifier to it when you become proficient. So that lets you have, you know, it's just a hand crossbow at that point in time. It's just a little
bit. Yeah, well, it's the reload property that makes it a little less useful, and probably the rarity of it as well. Like, you have to carry smoke powder with you to even use this thing.
Right. And you have to get proficiency with it, which takes specialized training. There is rules for modern items like the unautomatic pistol, revolver, hunting rifles, automatic rifles, and shotguns. excuse me. So the automatic rifle is the only one that I know of that has burst fire on it. Mm-hmm. So that's the one you fire at a cube and hit a lot of people. Overall, I think it's balanced or a little bit higher on the damage end, but overall, if you can fit them in without giving any spoilers away, even the more recently released campaign settings have pistols in them. Like I said, Waterdeep does.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a few others that that have mind flayers in the campaign settings.
Yeah, and apparently mind flayers use laser weapons. Which
and
is
mind flayers use laser pistols and antimatter.
Mind you, I still hate this. I think it's absolutely stupid. But the fact is, this has been a thing since second edition Dungeons and Dragons. Fucking Spelljammer started this shit, and it's always I can't even say it really stuck around because you never see it. It doesn't really pop up. But every once an edition, I think. Maybe once or twice per edition of D&D, laser weapons make an appearance.
Right.
I don't get it. I don't like it, but it is a thing.
So here's a question I have. When you fire a laser pistol, what kind of damage does it deal?
It does the pew, 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 pew sound. And I don't know what kind of damage, but you have to make the sound when you fire it.
Pew, pew. It does radiant damage.
Yeah. Should do fire damage, personally. But
and the antimatter rifle does necrotic damage.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
So there's three futuristic rifle items. There's a laser pistol, which is 3d6 radiant, reload of 50, range of 40-20. The antimatter rifle, 6d8 necrotic.
Good lord.
Right. 120-360, reload 2 shots, two-handed. And the laser rifle, which is 3d8 radiant, which is two-handed, range of 100-300, and 30-shot reload.
Wow.
Yeah. I like the pistols. I like the Drow gunslingers. I like their flavor.
I really do want to hate it, but I can't. Like it almost makes sense. And the Bregan D'Arth, specifically Jarl Axel as their leader, he's always been sort of a Renaissance style character. For him to, I know he doesn't wield pistols as far as I know, but if him or his people had them, it just kind of makes sense.
So what also makes sense to me too is that when Drow were first introduced, my understanding was is that they were the only class that could do this whole weapon hand crossbow style of dueling. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what they do in Waterdeep. They, you know, have their melee weapon and their pistol at the same time.
Yeah.
So, you know, one short sword and a pistol attack, you know?
Yep.
And that sets them apart now because everybody liked the whole hand crossbow long sword attack from the Drow base that everybody freaking uses it. If you're a Drow, you get it automatically. If not, you can feed into it, and it's very effective.
Yeah, they always had, they always had a sleep poison on their crossbow bolts. That was sort of the thing as well.
So the Drow gunslinger, it's got its pistol, the poison pistol, 1d10 plus 4 pistol damage, and then 2d10 poison damage.
My God.
You fuck around with the Drow like between 1 and 4, levels 1 through 4, and you're dead. Stab, bang.
Yeah, that's a little much. Now, here's something that I got to thinking about earlier with smoke powder specifically, because if it explodes, it does 96 damage for a barrel.
Right. Okay. Yep.
Okay, so it is heavily outlawed unless you have a permit and so forth. This makes literally no sense to me. They have outlawed this product despite the fact that all throughout the North, there are wizards everywhere who can drop fireballs all day long. Like, you have things way, way more powerful than smoke powder, yet they're not outlawed. I mean, some asshole drops a, you know, what was it, a tsunami or meteor swarm. You think they give two shits about a little barrel of smoke powder?
It is kind of weird because, like, you know, when you think about it, like, necklace of fireballs, when you think about that.
Yeah.
It's another wondrous rare item, and that's how, you know, Waterdeep starts, is someone casting a fireball. And I guess spoilers for that campaign setting, but it's been out for a
few years now. Yeah.
I mean, that's how that campaign starts, like, for real. It starts with a fireball going off in public, killing a bunch of people. And yeah, no one really regulates the flow of magic items in or out of Waterdeep, you know.
But you're going to outlaw smoke powder. Get fucked.
Well, I mean, in 5th edition, it doesn't particularly say that it's outlawed anywhere.
Well, that's just what I was reading earlier. It's supposed to be illegal unless you've got a permit. If you get a permit for it, which was like 500 gold, you then are only able to use it very specific ways, you know, to keep within the legal means of it. You're only it will also have two wizards and two guards overseeing it the entire time it's in your possession.
Yeah.
Like, that's what the 500 gold is used to pay for, is the people overseeing it.
And I've always kind of wondered that too in a D&D settings, why mages, wizards, anyone who can cast spells, warlocks in particular with, like, you know, a demonic pact to them. Like, why that stuff was never regulated and like, trying to grab under control. Because, like, you look at other settings like Dragon Age, where if you can cast spells, you get shift off to the no-no place where you have to spend the rest of your life because you're casting spells.
Yeah, Dragon Age was fantastic for its setting, specifically because there were two major shifts that I saw in Dragon Age, and it was, one was that if you're a spellcaster, you're pretty much thrown into a prison where you will live the rest of your life. You know, they let you occasionally go out here and there, but you're watched constantly, at least within Ferelden you were, within that country. Then there was what happened with the Dalish, which were the elves. So in every other setting I can think of, the elves are the pinnacle of society, the cream of the crop, the top dog of all races, other than maybe dragons. Mm-hmm. In Dragon Age, they had lost the war. They had been massacred and pretty much, you know, just beaten into submission. So they were the equivalent of, say, a gully dwarf from Dragonlance. They were the bottom of the barrel. They were all a bunch of thieves, cutthroats, low lives, and poor. And they, you know, they just lived in little hovels within the cities. Then you had the Dalish, who lived outside. They were the more of the traditional elves, but they were kind of like the wild elves. But even then, they were still very, very looked down upon, closely watched, and mistrusted. So, yeah. Dragon Age. I loved Dragon Age for that dynamic. That was just a complete and utter switch that I had never seen before.
Yeah, and I really like that. You know, I guess in high fantasy settings like D&D, you really can't have that because everyone's, you know, it sucks not being able to play your caster class that you want to play. But in Dragon Age, it worked real well. I never played the RPG version of it, so I don't know how well that worked in there. But
mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same thing. I've read through the entire books of the RPG. I considered running it a while back and just never had the chance.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, you got around it in the game, you know, for being what was it, the Grey Warden?
Mm-hmm, yeah,
Grey Warden. Yeah, I mean, you got around it because like you you get a free pass on doing everything illegal.
Yeah, pretty much. you get that.
Blood mages, they're mine.
You get that legal immunity everywhere.
So anyway, that was really kind of a really cool setting. And you know, it kind of helped shape like the campaign that I wanted to write, you know, for my own personal thing. Like, you know, magic is great. Magic is awesome. It's fun to do all the cool stuff and the cool spells. But at the end of the day, it kind of takes a lot of the fun out of the game, especially when you get to higher levels. Because, oh shit, we have to take over this town? All right, Tsunami. Fuck you,
yeah.
DM.
Yeah.
So, actually, on that note, what was actually kind of funny was, tonight's game was meant for 8 players. Okay. Mm-hmm. 4 showed up.
So half of what you were expecting. If six had made it, you could probably not alter the encounters that much. But with half, yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I altered one of the encounters. I had, actually, to be fair, I had this massive island, and on the island there are just a bunch of doors everywhere. Okay, and I removed 2 archers from the 4 archers, 4 guards, 2 priests, 1 high priest, and a champion level mob. So I took away 2 archers and 1 of the champion level mobs, and they were able to clear the encounter. A lot of it was just them rolling over 20s on their attacks because all these guards had 20 AC because they're wearing full plate. So that was just a miracle on their part. But they had lost 1 party member. The other one was paralyzed, not able to do anything, stuck in the middle of all this. So two rogues snuck in, and they pretty much just assassinated half the camp by themselves. And then we went down to do the final encounter, and I shit you not, they beat the final encounter mostly because they cast sleep twice. One sleep. Took out
sleep?
Sleep twice. So they cast it, the first time they cast it, like the person rolled like something like 30 something. 28. She rolled 28 and put the high priest to sleep because she, even though she's higher CR, she had lower hit points. And then a couple turns later, one of the mobs is running around to wake up the high priestess, the lower end priestess. She has more hit points. The guy casts sleep on her. He rolls a 33. That's her exact hit points.
Oh, wow. Sleep.
So both of the casters in this three CR, two CR2 monsters, one CR3 monster versus two level three players, two level four players. They put the two casters to sleep immediately.
That's some luck is what that is. But hey, if it worked out, great.
They just fucking caked walked it right over the champion. Just, oh, it's just you now? Stab.
Yeah, that's absolute luck. I had one of my players in Icewind Dale the other day try to cast sleep. And yeah, I mean, it just didn't affect anything because he didn't have enough. It just wasn't able to do it. He rolled 1 point less than the monster's current hit points.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it sucks.
But it just goes to show you, even at level like 3, one spell can just negate an encounter. Yeah.
Tasha's hideous laughter and shit like that can all just ruin encounters.
So then when you get to the higher level spells like Tsunami, Meteor, Wish, you know,
yeah,
the really cool ones, Simulacrum, Clone, like, you can really start just bending the rules, and you've kind of moved outside of being adventurers to, well, how do I beat this quest and not commit genocide at the same time?
Yep. Like, the thing is, with like high-level spell casting can alter encounters, but damage output-wise, you will never be the equivalent of other classes. You just can't. Which is why I never understand why everybody plays evokers. Evokers at the, when you get fireball, it's nice. But so I'm playing in a game, we're all 10th level, and we're in a fight the other day. I am playing a fire focused evoker wizard, and if I roll really good with my best fire spell, I'm gonna do maybe 40 damage if I'm damn lucky. And we had a, mind you, this is a broken ass combination of classes and whatnot, but a rogue fighter ranger who is, he's Gloomstalker. So in the first round of combat, he pumped out 161 fucking damage on one target.
So that target's gone.
And then, well, it was the big bad evil guy, so it lived. But yeah, I mean, it fucked him up very, very badly. And, you know, the first round of combat, that much damage. I then spend the rest of the combat even trying to get spells to stick. And, you know, then him saving against them and so forth. Yeah, I think throughout that entire thing, because he was dispelling things, and he also had lair effects that if you were casting spells third level or higher, there was a chance that it countered the spell.
Yeah.
Like, I ended up doing, I don't know, maybe 30 damage the whole battle. So, yeah, evoker wizards are not the way to go, let me tell you. If you're going to do high level, go enchantment. Enchantment's the shit.
I haven't played a high level caster in 5th edition. I've gotten as high as, I think, level 5, unfortunately. You know, and I just stick to the, you know, the tried and true methods of, you know, hold person, dominate.
Yeah, and most of those spells in 5th edition aren't that, they're okay, but they're not nearly as good as they used to be.
Right.
You know, like hold person, things like that. If they fail their save, they're held. But every round, they get that chance to break it.
Yeah, and it almost feels kind of shitty too, because like I've been in a couple situations DMing for a game, and like, okay, I'm the caster, and I could cast hold on this person,
mm-hmm.
or I could ready an action as a monster to cast a spell when it's the rogue's turn. Like, I don't know the legality of doing that. I never have, but like, you almost have to do that in a way.
Why is that?
Because like, so like in the situation is usually like, okay, the priest or caster goes, then the player you just did it to goes, and they get a free automatic save on that, or, you know, or they get a chance to save on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's two saves they get against your spell, assuming the first one hit, you know, and you get the other one.
Well, no, okay. So I'm a player, and I cast hold monster, whatever they call it, on a monster. On my turn, I cast it. He fails his save. He is then held. He goes through his turn, and at the end of his turn, he gets another save.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It's shitty because you almost have to wait until the player that you want to attack him while he's held, it's his turn, so you get the full benefit of it. So, like,
I see what you're saying. Yeah. I wouldn't do it that way, but
it feels like crappy, but that feels like the only way we can kind of like make those spells worthwhile. Because I ran into that situation tonight where the priest cast, you know, whole person on the elf. She failed. You know,
mm-hmm.
turns come through, one ranger gets an attack against her, hits and crits, you know, that good stuff. But then it's immediately her turn. She doesn't get her turn. She passes the save. She's no longer paralyzed. That's like the best scenario of that.
Right.
But if I would have just, you know, waited until after her turn to cast it, two guards could have just popped up and like both had shots at her. One ranger.
And you're absolutely right. Like that is, if you're working in tandem with your team, that is absolutely the best way to do it.
But it feels crappy as a DM doing that to players.
It feels crappy as a player doing that. As a spellcasting player, I don't even do that stuff. I just do it on my turn how it's supposed to be done. Despite the fact that, yes, I could probably have more effect if I waited until after they went.
Which kind of steers into a conversation of initiative, okay?
Again.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, but in Greyhawk, you rolled initiative every turn, right?
You mean in early edition? Like first edition, second edition?
Yeah.
No, as long as I can't say for first, I never played it. For second edition, it's been forever since I played, but I'm pretty sure you only roll it at the beginning of combat. Man,
I'm looking. I looked it up right now. The Greyhawk Initiative. You roll initiative every turn. So every round.
Yeah, be very, very specific, because round and turn have completely different meanings then.
So you roll initiative, it goes from high, you know. Sorry, initiative now runs from low to high. Creatures of lower initiative can act in combat before creatures of higher initiative. But essentially, you re-roll initiative every round.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of get a mix-up of things that happen. Now, if I'm sitting at a table with my players, fuck that. You want to add an hour to your game combat time. That is horrible.
Yeah.
But
probably why they got rid of it.
But on D&D Beyond, it would be seamless. Because when you step through the encounter tracker, when you get to the end, and you click next and you go to the next round and it goes back up to the top, you could have it automatically re-roll initiative for everybody. Like it was a toggle and just rearrange everybody. I think that'd be really cool. I think that would add a flavor to an element to combat that was very unique.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that would add more of a dynamic to the system. Currently the system doesn't do that. And if it wasn't automatic, I would never try it.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm going to write down that question right now while you talk about it for a little bit. So I can ask D&D Beyond developers that specifically.
Well, all right then. I don't know what I'm going to talk about. You just drop this bomb on me. How about that?
You're welcome.
Thanks. So, hi guys. How's everyone doing today?
How do you spell initiative?
I-N-I-T... damn it. T-A? I don't remember. I can normally do this, but... I-N-I-T-I-A-T-I-V-E. Thank you, Google.
Oh, you Googled it? You cheater.
Well, my brain is trying to think about what I'm going to talk about while you do this. So I want to talk about the greatest spell of all time, Psychic Scream. And I might...
Well, I wrote the question. We can go back now.
Oh, okay, good, because I didn't want to talk about this spell again. I think I did that 2 podcasts ago.
But if I could do that and actually add that into, like, you know, an automatic thing, I think that would really spice up combat, because, like, bringing in other gaming systems that I've played, Final Fantasy X,
mm-hmm.
playing that game with their initiative tracker, where, like, you have your initiative, but they're like, if you cast a spell, your initiative gets pushed down
right.
a little bit because you have a recovery time to it. Whereas if you're just doing, you know, quick melee attack, you could actually move up an initiative. And then, like, you had abilities that would push enemies down, delay them, stun them a little bit, you know.
Spells actually used to have different initiatives.
Oh, okay.
Like, second edition. I'll go look at it. I can't recall how this worked off the top of my head. But, spells absolutely. Sometimes they would take a full round to cast. So if you started casting them on your turn at the start of your turn, they would cast at the beginning of your next turn.
That's neat.
Yeah, like, it was just another way of handling spells. Mind you, spells, they were more powerful than they are now. Everything is very, very streamlined and just sort of rotates off of what Fireball does now. And there, you know, all the damage is sort of based around that. In second edition, man, second edition was the Wild West of spell casting.
So, yeah, so I really think having that kind of system automated into 5e would add a layer of fun to it.
I don't hate it, yeah, but it would be one of those situations of I'm not doing that every turn, and I'm fairly sure that's why they killed it.
Yeah, definitely.
That's definitely a lot of extra rolling and then having to write down who goes when and so forth. Just a lot of work.
And it also brings it back to, like, you know, it makes Dungeons & Dragons feel a little too video gamey in a way.
Yeah, it does.
Which is still really weird. I follow a couple people on Twitter, and one of them earlier this week tweeted out a say something positive about 4th edition.
Yeah, I saw that you posted something about that.
Right. I posted a whole bunch of stuff of positive things that I remember from 4th edition. At the end of the day, someone commented it back to me after I stated that, you know, I played 4th edition for 5 years and I never had a bad game because of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I only had bad games because players refused, you know, balked at it, you know, said they hated it. And, you know, you'd ask them, hey, did you ever play a game of 4th edition? No, I hate that system. It's like a video game. But you've never played it. No, I've never played it. I'm going to stick with my 3.0.2575 edition.
Here's the thing. There are no bad systems. There are only bad players or game masters.
Well, I mean, there probably are bad systems. Let's be fair.
No, there really are not. You can take any role-playing system, and if the players are okay with how it runs or how the DM is running it, then it'll play out just fine. If you have people who are not interested in being a part of it, then it makes it much more difficult.
Yeah.
There are systems that naturally flow better than others, but I really and truly don't think there's any actual bad systems. Like, I've played through, I can't think of the name of it, but basically it was a system that was just, it was play pretend. You had one die roll that you were allowed to make the entire game. and that was it. And you had a narrative on what you were starting as, not who you were starting as, but the situation you were in. And you just had to role play it out. And this, we did this a couple of different times, and we played for 3-4 hours each game session. Went great. And there wasn't really any dice rolling. It was just one person feeding off of the other. Yeah. So, like, that's such a narrow system. There's so very little to it, and yet we still had a great time with it.
Yeah. And that's ultimately, like, my final comment to that whole thread was, is that, you know, I've never had a bad game of 4E because of the system. And someone actually responded to my comment about that, and his comment was, it's funny how things in 5th edition or 4th are 4th edition ideas, but no one hates them in the new edition.
Well, I think that's because they got rid of there was two things that they've done specifically with 5th edition that kind of fixed what 4th edition was, because I'm quite aware that it's very similar. One is advantage. Advantage, yes. Disadvantage, fucking brilliant. I love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, when that happened, when they were doing D&D Next and they playtested that,
mm-hmm.
I immediately took that and added that to my 4th edition games, because that is probably the best role-playing change that I've ever seen in any game. It was just fantastic.
Yeah, it worked great. The other one, 4th edition more or less had it's almost like you had cards of what you could do each turn. You know,
that's similar to my thoughts, but I'll let you finish.
I mean, that's not, you know, there's not a lot more to say, but it felt like every time I wanted to cast a magic missile or whatever, I'd play out my magic missile card. You know, if I wanted to do this other thing, I'd have to play out a card. It that's what it felt like to me. It just felt so stale, like I was playing a board game.
So that is, for the people that I've talked to who've played 4th edition and are critical of it, there are 3-ish major flaws to 4th edition.
Yeah, now I am no expert. I've played maybe 3 games of it in my life.
Right. But at least your comment was more on the mark then. It's just a video game.
Mm-hmm.
The first problem was that there was too much math. And with the too much math, part of the reason why there's too much math, there's too much going on from status effects. So, like, advantage in 4th edition was +2. And then if there was cover, then it's -2. And there was just calculation of what you had to do and remember, especially with, like, status effects going on, because there were a ton of status effects in 4th edition.
Yeah. So it suffered from the modifiers problem that 3rd edition suffered from.
Right. And that caused a lot of the problem. The second is that once you got past about level 10 to 13-ish, remember, 4th edition went to level 30.
Yeah.
Once you pass like that level, like the 13 to 15, 10, 13, 15-ish level, it became a game of not what does your character do, but what order do we as a group do our abilities. So you could essentially take all your cards, like you mentioned, you could put them in a particular order, and that's how every single round of combat worked for the rest of the game from 15 to 30.
Yeah, and No. I'll pass on that.
It started with the cleric stun, then it followed up with the fighter attack, followed by the fighter action surge, and then the fighter this, and then
that right there is why I say, and everybody else I guess says, it felt like a video game, because if you're a World of Warcraft fan and you get, you know, all of these massive boss fights, you know, okay, he does this, it's time to stun, he does this, this is what you do, now after he's stunned, these rogues have to be in position to do this, and it's literally never going to change, it's just a boss fight.
That problem didn't occur until you were at higher level.
Right. Well, and World of Warcraft doesn't. It does sort of happen before then, but you primarily will see that on the massive boss fights at the later portions of the game.
Yeah. So levels 1 through 8 were a lot of fun. So the third major problem is the encounter daily and at will powers.
Mm-hmm.
being on cards, but the problem is not that they were on cards, okay? Because you show me a wizard in 4th edition with all their cards, you show me a wizard in 5th edition with all their spell slots, it's the same thing. It's just presented differently.
Yep.
But the problem is that every single class had those same exact at-will encounter daily reactions. And they were just kind of all grouped together like that. So they didn't have different flavors. So a fighter felt the same as a wizard, felt the same as a scion, felt the same as a barbarian. They didn't play really differently.
Yeah.
The classes that did, like the Avenger and the Barbarian from the Feywild, are highly remembered because they were unique and different versus all the other classes that had that same, just, okay, which encounter daily or at will power do I use at this juncture?
Yep.
So when they moved away from that in 5th edition, it feels fantastic.
Yeah, I have played the literal hell out of all the board games, the D&D board games, which are all based off of the 4th edition system. Yeah, you actually get the cards, you get your at wills, you get your dailies, and so forth. And it works beautifully as a board game. I just would not want to keep doing that as a tabletop. You're only playing for an hour. You're going through this thing, but yeah, I want variety of character, you know, and that, whether that be through role playing or it needs to be through role playing and through the build of the character.
Yeah, and there's a lot of problem too because they front loaded things with feats, like, and this is a show for like how the difference in why how what they. There were words that I am saying now.
Language.
And this is what separates just DMs from good DMs. So Chris Perkins was DMing an Acquisition Incorporated game. Mike Krahulik was playing his legendary character, Jim Dark Magic. And he wanted to use prestidigitation to dim the lights, make himself seem bigger, and use that as an intimidation check. Essentially, substitute Arcana for Charisma to intimidate. Chris Perkins said, perfect, awesome, do it. And he went with it.
Yeah.
When you go to 4th edition, that's not something you can do. You're supposed to play everything by the book. However, there is a feat you can get that does that exact same thing, lets you sub Arcana and place a Charisma for Intimidate. Just like there's a feat for you to sub Athletics and place a Charisma Strength and place a Charisma for Intimidate. I said Arcana, so I meant Int. Like, those situations are just base rules in 5th edition.
Yeah.
So, there were problems. You could nitpick a lot of things in 4th edition, but at the end of the day, you know, I think it was a good stepping stone into 5th. And I know we talked in the past about like what's next, because they seem to kind of like the rounding out the life circle of an edition. Yeah.
Well, Tasha's comes out in like 2 days, or maybe it's tomorrow even.
Well, when the time the podcast comes out, it comes out.
It'll be the day the podcast comes out. So yeah, I don't know what more they can release. I'm sure they'll keep doing stuff, but yeah, the next edition's got to be on the docket at this point.
Like, I really don't think that they need another edition. I think they just need to focus some campaign settings past level fucking 11. Like,
that would be nice. That's not everyone.
Everyone is just 1 through 11, and then when you really dial it down, 1 through 5 is just throwaway. You just start at 5.
Yeah, we'll see.
Icewind Dale. You know,
when I'm done with Icewind Dale, I may just keep running in Icewind Dale.
Yeah.
You know, the campaign doesn't have to end there. I could keep running.
Yeah.
So I have one last thing I want to talk about briefly before we wrap this sucker up. So do you think that time travel should ever be a storytelling device in D&D specifically?
What do you mean?
So I look at all the other time travel shows, book. Let's just stick with shows and movies specifically. Very few of them are done well. Most of them have so many loopholes in them. And a lot of it, I think, just stems from the fact that humans actually don't really understand how time travel really works. We just don't have a grasp on that because we've never done it. But you'll see these stories and they'll just have, you know, flaws in their storytelling and, you know, loopholes and openings. And, well, why did this happen? Why didn't it happen this way? This would have made more sense. Now this guy, he can come back through time. And I don't even know why this idea popped in my head, but it just did. Like today, time travel, I think, is generally just a lazy writer's method of doing things. And I was just kind of wanting to get your opinion on whether time travel should ever be a thing in Dungeons and Dragons. As far as I know, it never really is, but I've had DMs that have done it before. Sometimes it works out great. Other times it can go horribly, horribly wrong.
So when time travel is done poorly, it just creates a bunch of problems. When time travel is done well, with a lot of thought, it's usually really good. So the most recent example of a time travel story, spoilers, is Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
Which is, I would say, on the poor side of how they handle time
travel. Yeah. Mind you, I absolutely fucking love those movies. I will sit here and watch them every time every opportunity I really have to watch them. Fun as hell. But yeah, they're kind of poorly done.
You can nitpick whatever you want, okay? Like the whole scenario. I'm just going to state this. In the first movie, the Ancient One said that if a Infinity Stone is removed, it creates a branch reality. Because the Infinity Stones as a whole regulate the flow of time, okay? Those are the words she said. The Infinity Stones regulate the flow of time. And what's the first thing that happens in Endgame?
They remove one.
No.
I don't remember.
Thanos destroys the Infinity Stones.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
So how does time keep existing once he's destroyed all the Infinity Stones?
Uh-huh.
They just like, oh, shit. Did we say that? Oh, yeah. Never mind.
Yeah, we're just going to overlook it. Yeah, and that's kind of my point, because there will always be loopholes and flaws in thought process when you deal with time travel.
So then you look at other time travel shows, and I'll take Doctor Who as the next example, which they don't care. They will travel through time and do whatever Monsters of the Week story they want to do.
Legends of Tomorrow does that too, and it's absolutely enjoyable.
Right. It's enjoyable. It's fun. No one cares about the problems that come up with time traveling and like meeting Shakespeare or whatever, because
kidnapping Socrates and bringing him back or bringing him forward in time so that he can, you know, help do your study at, you know, at San Dimas High.
Yeah. So like it doesn't matter in those time travel stories, and I think those are the ones that are more important. And I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast at all, but there was, and there is a story out there about a guy who sent his D&D players back in time and described the same.
Oh, the mountain. No, yeah, you did talk about this. Yeah, a couple episodes back.
So you can fall into that situation where like, oh shit, what happened to the mountain? Oh, it was a Tarrasque. And those are fine too, you know? So it really depends on what you're trying to drive home with the time travel narrative. Are you writing a Doctor Who story where the wibbly wobbly timely wimey stuff doesn't matter at the end of the day? Or are you trying to have a very concise, consistent plot with real time travel rules that you want to follow, a la like Back to the Future?
Yeah, and I guess it really does depend on the campaign.
I
played in some campaigns that are lighthearted, goofy, and fluffy, and for those to have that Doctor Who feel to them would be just fine. But I've also played and run a lot of them that are very sort of straightforward and serious. So time travel runs a massive risk in those kinds of games.
So I guess on a final note, there are a number of Star Trek slash Doctor Who crossover.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the Star Trek Doctor Who assimilation crossover that happened in like 2012, where the Cybermen teleport to an alternate dimension, which is the Star Trek universe, and they wind up getting caught by the Borg, who assimilate the Cybermen. And at the end of the comic, you know, there's a bunch of cool stuff happens, but at the end of the comic, when they resolve all the problems, the Borg got the time travel technology that they have from the Cybermen.
Oh, no. Okay. Yeah.
And that's what caused all the time travel problems in Star Trek Generations.
Fucking Doctor Who. Leave it to him. Damn it. All right. I think that's about enough for this week. We will see you guys next time. Bye, Craig.
Goodbye, Craig.